No.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. It is February 16th already. We're going to take Senator Girard on Senate Bill 495. So I'm going to open a public hearing. House Bills 409. I'm only going to hear the members, and then we'll do the bill later. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. For the record, I'm Senator Fred Girard, representing Senate District 9. I'm before the committee today to introduce House Bill 4095 and the -1 amendments to you at the request of the bill's chief sponsor, my good friend, Representative Vic Gilliam, who could not be here today. Rep. Gilliam prepared a short message that he asked me to read into the record. My commitment to this bill stems from a personal story from an Oregon dentist who testified last spring. This dentist made a minor practice management error over a decade ago. She self-reported her error to the Oregon Board of Dentistry and has been in good standing with the board moving forward. Yet information of this event is still present in material published by the board. It is my belief that dental professionals should have the ability to wipe the slate clean if they meet the following criteria outlined in House Bill 4095. 1, the violation occurred over 10 years ago. 2, the violation did not involve harm to a patient, either financially or physically. 3, the violation is self-reported to the board. 4, the licensee has zero violations since, and 5, the licensee has complied with all penalties. The chair of the House Health Care Committee offered ample time for stakeholders to discuss the bill, and while I was not informed of their activity and discussion, I firmly believe now it is time for this action. I urge passage of this reasonable, balanced approach. It comes to you with unanimous support from the House Care Committee and the House Chamber. Colleagues, this really is truly just about self-reporting, and it's something that we want to encourage. The -1s were requested by the board, and basically all it does is define what good standing is. And so that's why the -1s are encouraged. I would ask for a passage, and I think it's a good bill.
Thank you, Senator Girard, and I'm sure we will hopefully pass it today. Any questions?
Any questions at all?
No.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll just temporarily close 4095 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4104, Representative Noss.
Is that good? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Rob Noss. I'm representative for House District 42 in Southeast Portland, a little sliver of Northeast Portland. And today I'm bringing your committee House Bill 4014 for your consideration, where it passed on the House floor with no opposition. My understanding is that since the passage of the Affordable Health Care Act, this body has considered numerous bills related to health insurance. House Bill 4104 was written to help us as legislators do a better job when we craft legislation around the subject of health insurance. I'm sure most of you are aware there are a lot of different types of health insurance plans and products that all vary in quality and cost and what they cover. Not all these different types of insurance are designed or function in the same way. But often when legislation is passed relating to health insurance, it's done with comprehensive medical insurance in mind. House Bill 4104 creates a new statutory category or definition for insurance plans that are designed to cover specific injuries and illnesses, credit or disability income, dental-only insurance, vision-only coverage, and hospital indemnity plans, which we're going to call limited benefit coverage. Creating this definition will help to clarify the intent of future legislation. That's the bill. I hope you'll pass it.
Questions?
I only got two. My other one's a little harder.
Senator.
Yeah, I'm a senator now.
That means a lot.
I like this approach. One of the problems with health insurance now, according to the feds, is it's got to be in the metal levels, and it doesn't allow anybody to purchase pure catastrophic coverage sort of thing. And I think this is moving us hopefully in that direction.
At least it defines what pure catastrophic health insurance would be. That's what this would do in the statute. So if we make a law around that kind of insurance or around medical, we'll have to be a lot clearer about that, comprehensive medical.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
I will temporarily close.
See you next week, or no, Thursday, right? That's when we're going to do biosimilars.
Temporarily close House Bill 4104, and we're going to open an informational meeting on and ask Pat Allen and Laura Kelly to come forward and give us an update on the MOTA situation.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm joined today by Laura Kelly, who runs our Division of Financial Regulation and is the state's insurance commissioner. We're going to do a little bit of a tag team today and share giving you a little bit of the run-up to the MOTA situation and then the resolution that we're in the process of implementing right now, and then see if there are questions that you have. The punchline, as you know, is that we have entered into a consent order with the company. But the circumstances that led to that really are not something that just happened in the last two or three weeks. This has been an issue that we've been working on for a bit of time, and so I'll turn it to Commissioner Kelly to start that story.
Thanks, Pat. And Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Kelly, and as Pat said, I'm the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation and the insurance commissioner. So as Pat also said, this situation didn't arise overnight, I guess almost 3 weeks ago now as we sit here. It really started quite a bit further back, and so I think it's important to have a little bit of context about how we got here and what the circumstances were that led us to this point. So if we think back to October 1st of last year, CMS made a significant announcement, and the announcement was that they were going to be paying 12.6% of what they owed under the Federal Risk Corridor payments for 2014. And I think probably this committee is well aware of that. It was pretty widely reported on, but the Risk Corridor payments were designed to help insurance companies who had mispriced misestimated the cost of their of covering their insureds. And it's a three-year program, and 2014 was the first year. MOTA had the lowest rates in our individual market in 2014 and had a very significant risk corridor receivable on its books for 2014 as well as 2015. But other carriers also had expected receivables from the risk corridor, so it wasn't just a MOTA issue. But as you can imagine, having the lowest rates, having a significant amount of money on their books earmarked for this, that 12.6 cents on the dollar was a significant departure and resulted in a significant write-down of that receivable. And so this also coincided with the weeks leading up to the beginning of open enrollment. And so it was important for us to look at not just MOTA, but really all of the health insurers in our market to understand their financial condition, make sure that they were in a place where they could safely enter open enrollment and offer renewals to their existing members and take on new members. And so we went through a process really with all of the insurers, the health insurers in our market, to make sure that they were in a financially stable enough position to enter open enrollment. And that really was just a matter of course and really important to our underlying responsibility to protect the insurance consumers in our market. So based on the information that we had at that time heading into open enrollment, I think it was again widely reported that MOTA had some significant capital that they put forward, that we along with other carriers, MOTA entered open enrollment and was able to offer new policies and renew their existing customers. If we then fast forward a few months, we're now at the beginning of 2016, which is a point where most or all of the insurance companies are preparing their year-end financial statements. Those are due to us typically at the end of February, so usually March 1st is the date at which those are available and become public. And insurance companies will be working on tying together all their numbers for the first couple of months of the year. We got a heads up from our fellow regulators in Alaska, and they had asked a very specific Alaska question trying to understand what was going on in their market in terms of premium and exposure. And they uncovered some information that they assessed would actually be potentially material to the entire insurance company. And so they called us, which is really the way that state-based regulation is designed to work, that we work together with our colleagues in other states to make sure that we're sharing information. And because of that specific question they asked, they were able to tip us off that we needed to have some more conversations with the company. So that information led to us having a series of conversations with the company and to the supervision order that was issued in late January. And from there, I'll turn it back over to Pat.
Thanks. Just to dwell for another minute on the Alaska piece of this story, because it's a little bit counterintuitive. Alaska, as a percentage of MOTA's overall business, is relatively small. A couple of things that are important to know about that Alaska exposure. One is that they're one of only two carriers up there, so their existence in that market is important in Alaska. And second, unlike Oregon, they have a significant exposure in the Native Alaskan, Native American market, and one of the features for covering that population is the lack of a requirement that they observe or follow open enrollment periods, and so you're able to add coverage more or less at the time that you need it. Again, in Oregon, that's not a large enough population to be a significant factor in how claims history occurs. It's a big deal in Alaska, and that was really what the Alaska regulators were focusing on, was tell us about your premium revenue and your claims here in this market. Which is a relatively small piece of the overall pie, but the results were significant enough that they made us aware of that. So we, as Commissioner Kelly says, implemented an immediate order of supervision, which really is a regulator's way of saying just stop what you're doing. Stop everything. Stop selling policies. Stop renewing policies. Stop making significant business decisions. Just stop so that we can get in and take a look at things and figure out where you are and what's going on and what a plan is to be able to move forward and make sure consumers are protected. And I think when you read press accounts and discussions about that order when it first came out, it's fair to say that the company expressed, and we expressed support for, the notion that the resolution was they were going to get out of the individual market. They had some preferences about how they would do that. We knew in a worst-case scenario that the way they would get out of the individual market would be by virtue of opening what's called a special enrollment period, which is kind of like reopening open enrollment for their customers and letting them go and pick new carriers. That really, from our standpoint, was a worst-case scenario because there are all sorts of bad outcomes that occur if you do that. If you've already spent money toward out-of-pocket maximums and deductibles, you may lose that money. Whether your doctor is in network or out of network, benefit design, all those kinds of things would change, and you'd be starting over again midstream. And that disruption to consumers was something that we were really interested in trying to figure out how to avoid. What became clear over the course of the week or 10 days that we dealt with this is that there was not going to be a path that was going to, without a huge amount of disruption, allow the company to, I guess for lack of a better phrase, gracefully exit the individual market. They were not going to be able to quickly find someone to buy that business outright from them. And so we began exploring with them what would it take for them to be adequately capitalized to make good on their commitments to Oregonians. And that means being able to allow people to keep those policies through the periods for which they bought them. And so the company basically identified what it thought was a rough amount of money that it lost in 2015. They thought that their performance would be better in 2016, but we took the approach to say, well, what if it's actually worse than it was in 2015? And what if there's some other unanticipated big financial event that has a negative impact on your bottom line? And we add that, so we're not just where you were, but we're worse, and we add on top of that, how much money would that take to be able to capitalize you adequately, to be able to withstand that much bad news? And that's where we came up with $179 million as the key feature of the consent order that we entered into. And I'll turn it back to Commissioner Kelly to talk about the order.
Thank you. So the order, as I think many of you have seen, and we've provided copies as well, and it's been reported on publicly, consists of two parts. There's the public order, and there's also a reference to a financial a plan of action, or an RBC plan, that is confidential. And I think it's important to talk about what's in the public order versus not, and why it's important to keep the financial plan confidential as well. The consent order lays out kind of in broad strokes what are the key elements that MOTA has to fulfill in order to be able to make good on its commitments to Oregon policyholders and Alaska policyholders. And so I'll start by walking through that on a broad level and then talk a little bit about the importance of the financial plan. So the public consent order requires a number of things. First and foremost, as Pat's mentioned, it requires that the company basically raise $179 million in capital to ensure that it has the financial capacity to continue to service its customers. It doesn't specify in the public order exactly how the company will do that and when, and I'll talk about that a little bit when I get to the financial plan of action. It does set out that there are going to be enhanced reporting requirements for MOTA, that MOTA is going to be required to give more frequent, basically at least monthly, reports to us as well as to Alaska and Washington regulators as it has business in those two states. And in particular, they're going to need to provide us information about their efforts to manage their costs, because there has been some, they've been undertaking some efforts to reduce their costs and manage those, and so we need to have reporting about that. One of the pieces that is quite detailed in the consent order that I know has also raised some questions is the deposit being set up for the benefit of Alaska policyholders. So I'll talk a little bit about why that was set up and what that means. Oregon, as MOTA's home state regulator or the domicile state regulator, has certain rights and responsibilities. So we are their primary financial oversight regulator. We're responsible for ensuring that the company is meeting all of the required financial benchmarks to offer insurance anywhere. So we're kind of the first line of defense and have that primary responsibility to all of its consumers. Each state in which MOTA does business also has the right and responsibility to license them to transact in their state, and they have a variety of requirements that they impose on insurance companies to be able to do that. So a state like Alaska can say either yes, you can write in our state, or no, you can't for these reasons. But if there's a serious financial issue, Alaska can't take a company into receivership and actually seize control of their assets and say we're actually going to take matters into our own hands and make sure that the company is able to meet its obligations. Oregon, as the home state regulator, does have that set of responsibilities under the law, and that's pretty much standard across the country. Each state, as the state of domicile, has that set of rights and responsibilities. So in the event that there were a problem where MOTA were not able to meet its obligations, Alaska has requested to set up this specific fund to ensure the claims for their policyholders will be paid. But meanwhile, we as the home state regulator retain our rights and responsibilities to be able to exercise financial oversight over the company, and if needed, we can take more extreme regulatory action. So I think it's important to just illustrate why that's different. Generally speaking, we've also retained some key authority. In particular, we require that they notify us and ask for our permission before increasing any salaries or distributing any bonuses to their executives. So that all has to come through us. And everything that's laid out in the consent order is in addition to the responsibilities and rights that we already have in statute. So it doesn't compromise anything in terms of our ability to take swift action if it's necessary. But it really lays out a series of things that MOTA has to accomplish and has to provide to us. I'll switch over to the financial plan of action, the confidential document that is referenced here. It provides a great deal of detail about what specific transactions MOTA has to enter into, by when, and amounts. But just in the same way that if you told someone they had to sell a car by Friday for $5,000, you're going to significantly decrease the likelihood of them being able to get $5,000 by that Friday deadline. And so it's really important for the protection of their policyholders that they be able to execute on these transactions. So this is actually provided for in the statute that an RBC plan is considered confidential. It's a tool that we use regularly with any company that is having some solvency issues, and we need to work with them to get a plan in place to get them back to financial health. So it's not a tool that's unique in this circumstance. And so we're continually monitoring their progress against that plan to make sure that they're able to meet all of those deadlines. And one other piece that that I should mention here is that I just lost my train of thought.
Well, let me pick up with an element of the plan that's important to know. While we can't talk about the specifics in the plan, it is largely outside dollars, not internal accounting transactions. It is largely through the sale of assets, not taking on debt. There are both of those elements in there, but they're minority pieces. And it's a collection of actions that occur over a period of time that is not terribly long, and with elements that start almost immediately from the time that we entered into the consent order. So what we're really looking for is a plan that we believe is achievable, but that represents true capital coming into the company to support policies.
You just jogged my memory, so thank you, Pat. But the one piece I did want to point out is that some of these transactions are going to happen in the near term. And so I talked earlier about year-end financials being due to us at the end of this month. Some of the transactions, just under the way statutory accounting works, will actually allow the value of those transactions to show up in their year-end financials. That's not unique to MOTA. That is just a feature of statutory accounting and how they can reflect subsequent events in a certain period of time. So I think it's important to note that you'll start to see some of the impact of this plan show up in their year-end financials that will be available in a couple of weeks. And I think really important to note that this isn't an exception created for the company. This is just the mechanics of statutory accounting for regulatory purposes.
Let me talk about one last topic before we open it up for questions, and this seems inescapable when we talk about MOTA, and it's the naming rights on the Trailblazers arena. This is an issue that, first of all, I've had the opportunity to review the confidential agreement that there's a non-disclosure around between the Blazers and MOTA, and I can say that financially it's not a material circumstance. They could pay that or not pay that, and not paying it wouldn't make a significant difference in terms of their financial standing. Also, without wanting to reveal terms, just to be clear, this is an obligation they have over a period of years to make a number of payments. You would expect that having an obligation like that, you can't just walk away from that for free. And so, our intent in anything that we would try to review or do, or if we were to go into receivership and actually take control of, which is not what's on the table right now, we would need to balance those kinds of factors. But I want to make sure people understand, I totally get that the fact that their name is on the arena makes people mad. Not everybody, and not necessarily everybody in this room, but there are people who are just really bothered by that fact, and I completely understand that being mad isn't a great basis from which to regulate. And so what we've really tried to do is to look at what are the financial fundamentals of that or any other transactions that they're a part of to figure out what makes a meaningful difference in terms of the operation of the business to try to manage that and other issues. What this is really about is whether it's that obligation or obligations to any of their other vendors, or most importantly, their obligations to their policyholders, do we believe that we now have in place an adequate capital plan that will allow them to make good on all those obligations? With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions you've got.
Just briefly, I'm most concerned about the policyholders. And do you have data yet on those that have left MOTA? Have they been able to get other carriers? Are the claims being paid?
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, the MOTA through the end of open enrollment has about 62,000 individual policyholders, both on the marketplace and off the marketplace. That's in addition to various other lines of business that they have through PEB and OEB, Medicare supplemental coverage and those kinds of things. That's down from about 90,000 individual policies last year and about 110,000 policies the year before. That 62,000 figure, however, get into regulatory speak, is uneffectuated policies. That's before allowing for who's actually made their first payment. So that number will probably drop some yet from that. Typically, you see about 85% effectuation in our marketplace. We are monitoring claims payments and other customer service kinds of activities within the company to assure that there's not an ongoing claims payment issue, particularly to protect not just policyholders but also providers as well.
And if Chairman Sanderson, if I could just add to, we've heard from a number of consumers just kind of across the spectrum, some who had stayed with, had already had a MOTA policy, had stayed and were waiting for guidance about whether they need to make a change, and then expressed some relief that they weren't in a a spot where they had to start over with new deductibles, that sort of thing. We've also heard from some consumers who made a decision that they wanted to go elsewhere and start over. And so we know that there are kind of a number of customers who are in different situations depending on how they chose to react to the news that they were under supervision. But our message to consumers then was, hold tight. You know, our first priority is making sure that consumers are protected and that claims will be paid. But we were in a period of time where we were not allowing Moda to take on any new customers or renew any policies. So there were some people who were in a position where they had to make a different decision for a period of time. And there were some people who chose to make a different decision. And we're also working to make sure that anybody who might have been caught in a gap where they had, you know, maybe they had sent in a renewal and then they changed their mind and they want to make sure that they're covered, that we're working with them to find a solution.
So the website, I had a constituent who went on the website and saw that Moda was still listed and was asked me, well, you know, has the website been taken care of? I mean, has that been updated so when someone goes on, what is it, or healthcare.gov?
Yeah, as of about 6 o'clock Pacific time on that Friday before the end of open enrollment, they were taken down from the website. But if your constituent looked prior to that, from the 27th until that point, so about 2 or 3 days, they would have still been up. Now that we've entered into the consent order, we're restoring them to healthcare.gov. And I actually don't know if that has been accomplished or not as we sit today.
Senator Cruz and then Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I have a few questions here. First one, surplus notes. So what are they and how do they get repaid?
Sure. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz. So a surplus note is in some ways like an investment from an outside investor, and it has terms where it requires periodic interest payments, but the way that it's structured is that it's subordinate to policyholder claims. And so it basically stands in line behind other commitments that the company has made. And so because of the way it's subordinated, it can be reflected as surplus on the insurance company's balance sheet. And typically the feature with surplus notes, we have authority by statute to sign off on certain on repayments and payments of interest, and also in some of the terms of the surplus notes will be explicit about in what circumstances an insurance company can repay interest and what discretion we have to allow it or not allow it based on the financial condition of the company.
Okay, Madam Chair, another sense of scale, $180 million, where is it coming from outside of Moda and ODS?
That would be, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, that would be sale of assets typically. So we specifically talk, I think, in the press coverage about these receivables from the federal government that they will sell at a discount to outside purchasers. They have other assets that they would anticipate selling, as well as some amount of notes and those kinds of transactions. Most of what they're talking about doing is bringing money in through the sale of assets.
Does the consent agreement include the parent company?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, no. The consent agreement is with Moda Health Plan, which is the regulated entity. Moda Inc., which is the immediate parent, is not a regulated entity, but the ultimate parent of the whole. It's a pretty complex org structure. The ultimate parent is ODS, which is regulated by DCBS. But the consent order does not reach above to ODS.
Okay. And I'm just one more. What's your confidence level that this is going to work, and are you worried about other carriers in this conversation?
Sure, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz. We certainly had the opportunity to go a different direction than doing a consent order. We could have moved to receivership or other kinds of tools that we have available, and we, I don't think, had any hesitancy to do that if we thought that was the path that was going to protect Oregonians and be as minimally disruptive as possible for them. And so doing this, we're doing it because we think it's a plan that can work. We think that it's an adequate capital level that will carry the company through to meet all of its commitments, and we think the elements of the plan are achievable within the time frames and at the dollar amounts that we have set out. In terms of other carriers, I would simply say that at various reporting periods and other logical times like the beginning of open enrollment, we look very carefully at carriers to determine whether we think there are concerns that that need to be addressed. You saw before open enrollment, Health Republic made a decision that that we supported and are working through now to wind up its business, and they're in supervision now, as Moda was for a period of time, basically for that very same reason of what was their viability going forward through the course of the year. So it's an area that we keep close tabs on, and I think through this set of actions, we've demonstrated our willingness to take strong action if we think that's what's needed to protect Oregonians.
Okay, Manager, just one more comment, and you know, I don't want Oregon to end up like Alaska where nobody's willing to carry policies, and so this is a significant issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioners, you're both commissioners, really. MODA is considered a nonprofit, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And I think, you know, I understand there was a lot of volatility in the marketplace, but I think one thing we need to do is try to figure out how we don't let this kind of thing happen again. Sounds like you're on the right track for doing what needs to be done to clean up the mess, but it seems to me that with a lot of the nonprofits that are sitting on large amounts of surplus, we need to take a look at some of their major expenditures before they happen. I mean, I can understand why it's difficult to unwind the MODA Rose Garden now, but did MODA ever come to you and said, hey, we're thinking about putting $40 million into investing in a stadium? Is that something that you've ever reviewed before it happened, or is there, do you think that you should have that statutory authority to take a look at expenditures so that, you know, they don't shell out that kind of money and then all of a sudden we feel like we're stuck after?
Yeah, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, let me tackle that. I think and this feeds a little bit on the comment that Senator Cruz just made. In the ordinary course, we as government regulators think it's probably not a great idea for us to select the advertising strategies for private companies. And a lot of other business strategies within the general context of administration and the operation of those companies. Remember, this is in a context where federal law already regulates requires that a minimum percentage of their premium dollars go to paying claims. It's got to be at least 80%, or they owe rebates back to policyholders. Now, certainly in this context, if you get yourself in a problem, then yeah, we do have a different interest in looking at those kinds of transactions. And again, it then comes back to financial materiality. What happened, I believe, with MODA was not runaway administrative expenses. What happened were catastrophic claims expenses. And in particular, it appears from the information preliminarily available to us, stuff that was driven in particular, although not exclusively, in the Alaska market. Those are the kinds of things that we do absolutely have regulatory authority over. And if we get to a place where we need to put a company in receivership, then I think certainly all bets are off, and we take a look at all of those transactions in ways to figure out how to benefit Oregonians. But when you're talking about 6 months or a year, 3 years ago, looking at a company that, like every other company in Oregon, is operating in the ordinary course, I think within parameters of what kinds of percentages you need to pay on claims and those sorts of markers, no, we shouldn't try to be trying to make those individual business decisions as regulators.
Follow-up. So the other thing, I mean, I understand that the risk corridor was a big part of this, but wasn't it also that we allowed MODA to lowball the market and the individual market, suck up all these new policyholders, and then jacked up the rates shortly thereafter, causing all kinds of volatility? I mean, if you had to do it all over again, do you think we might not have let them lowball their rates quite as much?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields, so if we think back to the information that we had in actually it was in 2013 when we were reviewing and approving rates for 2014, there were a lot of unknowns and there was a lot of uncertainty. And based on the information that we had then, we and carriers and other policymakers had to make a lot of educated guesses about what the future may hold when we embarked into a post-ACA world. Most notably, what was going to happen when you had guaranteed issue and you had the effect of tax credits influencing decisions that people made about which health care to buy and also helping people afford to have access to things they hadn't had access to in the past. And we approved a range of rates, and you know, there it was a fairly broad range that I if I think back to probably discussions I have had with with this committee back at that point, was talking about there is not necessarily one right answer in terms of rates, and when you're looking at projections of unknown with uncertainty, you're even less likely to have convergence around a narrow range of right rates. What we've learned in the past couple of years is we now have our first full year of experience. We are just in about 3 weeks going to see the second full year of experience, is that we're learning what's actually occurred in that market in 2014 and 2015. And the losses were far more than we and than insurers had expected. Moda was, while it had the lowest rates in 2014, was certainly not the only carrier that lost money. Yes, they did get a lot of membership in 2014, but I think one of the really interesting things about this market is that because of open enrollment, people get the opportunity to make changes if they so choose, and we've seen that that's occurred. If we look at what happened in 2015 with rates, Moda took a relatively minor rate increase to cover trend. And, you know, I think, again, in a place where we in the industry did not have significant information about what happened yet in 2014, we were really still looking at a range of possible outcomes in terms of what would be an adequate rate. And, you know, in 2016, we made the hard decisions to increase rates to make sure that they were going to more adequately cover costs. So, you know, hindsight is 2020, but I don't think that we could have known then what we know now about the costs of this market.
If I could just add, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, we also, I think, were in a transition in the type of market that we're looking at, moving really from a public utility commission sort of a model where you, if you're not actually a monopoly, you function in many ways like a monopoly, and our job is to make sure essentially that your rates aren't too high, to a fully transparent, fully competitive marketplace where these businesses act as competitors. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's a really good thing for Oregonians. This is an area where that competition has created issues that that we've needed to come in and address. You'll remember last year, just about a year ago, we were here explaining why we were causing companies to raise their rates even further than they wanted to, and that wasn't super popular in terms of trying to stabilize the market. So I think that transition has been something that, looking back, it would have been helpful to have anticipated. I would say that we certainly weren't the only ones who didn't catch that. And the entire industry, not just Moda, lost money in 2014, 2015, and we've been trying to address that through the rate process.
One follow-up. I get that. The other thing is I would just suggest, I mean, I remember when Regents took a big chunk of cash, $50 million, and shipped it to another division. They called you and said, hey, you know, we're going to do this. Seems to me that we need to figure out a way to get ahead of some of these big expenditures if we're going to try to keep these folks solvent in the future. I mean, it's I'd much rather prevent these things from happening than deal with them after you get some information that, gosh, these guys are much more of a hole than we thought they were. So
sure, but I would hate to take a set of Regents facts and apply them to a Moda circumstance, because they are different circumstances, and if we had some kind of a significant transfer of capital out of Moda of that sort, right, you know, before this happened, I think that would be absolutely fair. That's not the circumstance we're dealing with.
Well, I mean, investment versus an expenditure, I think, is often semantics.
Well, if you want to take a 10-year figure and turn it into a 1-year figure, sure.
I think the other thing that's important to point out, though, is that, you know, we've talked a lot about the opposite issue of companies having what seemed like large capital cushions and some concern about what that meant in terms of rating, you know, future rate changes. And I think what we've seen happen in this market is that, you know, what may seem like a significant amount of capital can deteriorate quickly because of adverse claims experience. And so, you know, we have this dual responsibility. I mean, it all comes down to protecting the consumer at the core, but really it's this responsibility to keep rates reasonable, adequate to cover costs, but not too high that they're adding to an overly large surplus position, but also making sure that the surplus is large enough to weather a rainy day. That's what it's designed for. It's designed to be there to cover the adverse events when when a company gets hit with something it didn't expect, or, you know, things kind of continually break against them, and that's really what's occurred in this case. But I think it's a challenge. It's an inherent challenge when you're looking at insurance, which is the transfer of risk.
Any other discussion? Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the informational on the MOTA situation and open a public hearing on House Bill 4016A. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4016A comes to you from the House Health Care Committee and the House floor. Off the House floor, 59 ayes, 1 excused. The bill permits health professional licensing boards to establish or contract together to establish impaired health professional program for licensees of the boards. Permits the boards to consult with each other to adopt rules relating to the impaired health professional program. It also establishes the impaired health professional program work group to facilitate the establishment and continuation of the impaired health professional program. Has an emergency, is effective on passage. You have, there is a fiscal impact, but the impact is about the money that will be shifting from OHA out of the OHA budget. So it is basically a fiscal statement of explanation, not necessarily an impact to the board.
Kathleen Haley.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I serve as the executive director for the Oregon Medical Board. The Health Professional Services Program is a monitoring program for our licensees who suffer with a mental health or substance use disorder. And currently, under the law, the health authority administers that program. They can either contract or deliver those services. What we're proposing with this bill is that the four participating boards would take over that administrative function. And so we wouldn't be paying that fee to the health authority. It's about $300,000 for the biennium. This amount has been escalating, and rather than continue that, we think we can handle the contracting process. With this change, I hope that you will support this bill. Thank you.
And Kathleen, the four entities are
the dental, nursing, medical, and pharmacy.
Excellent. Okay.
That's the biggies.
Yep. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you very much.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4016 and open a work session on House Bill 4016.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4016A to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4016 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Mona Sanderson?
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Knope, do you want to carry?
Of course I do.
Senator Knope will carry the bill.
A little disrespect to your chairs in the work session on.
That wasn't disrespectful. She just broke my streak of not carrying a bill this session. So.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 4095, and we already had Senator Girard, I believe Georgia Coolidge.
And Stephen Prisby.
And Stephen Prisby.
So we got, we don't have the paperwork,
yes,
or do we? Oh, we do, okay.
Minimal fiscal notice.
Okay.
Proceed.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Prisby. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and I live in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the bill. Copies of the legislation have been passed on to the Oregon Board of Dentistry, but we have no official position. We require a meeting to take an official position. But I've been instructed and kept them in the loop on the bill. I've submitted written testimony, which is already provided to the House. And if you have any questions, I can go over that. the bottom line is the board is happy to work with the representatives of the ODA, the ODHA, and the legislators to craft legislation that's amenable to and works with everybody. The board will note that we would be the only board removing licensee information from our website with the inaction of this bill. All 18 healthcare boards have worked together from Representative Greenlick's direction to try to see if all the boards could come up with a similar way of removing discipline information. We have very different ways that we do that information, but currently all healthcare licensing boards leave the information on their websites or electronic publications indefinitely. The concern for us would be that we would be the only healthcare licensing board removing any discipline information. So we'll work together, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer any questions you have on this. Thank you.
Okay. Stay there, and we'll have
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. I'll keep my testimony relatively brief, since I think Senator Girard did a good job of sort of laying out its intent. We've worked with Representative Gilliam, Representative Greenwick over the last couple of sessions on this concept, and really it comes down to when you have really, really minor offenses that, again, don't financially or physically harm a patient. It's been, you know, 10 years. We look at these as you know, predominantly sort of procedural things, maybe some record keeping. I know this committee is familiar with some stuff work we did a couple sessions ago on spore testing, where maybe a dentist is reporting every 2 weeks instead of every 1 week, and they call and say, we just found out that we're supposed to report on a weekly basis instead of every 2 weeks. That, you know, after a significant period of time, it gives them an opportunity to come back and say, hey, I've had no other infraction. It's been 10 years. Can I remove this from the website? And I think the key point is this is something that's still open to public information requests. It's still, and I'm going to I'll probably botch the name of it, the federal database, I know, is the records are still on that federal database. So it really has to do with just the website. And so we'd hope that you would move it forward and support it. Thank you.
One question I have is, are we the only state that has self-reporting, or does every state have, all boards have self-reporting?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I don't know if every state does. I believe most do. Okay. Of some sort.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I resonate with your point about the board ministry being the only one to do this. You know, we just had the testimony from Ms. Haley about the Health Professionals Program, which was around four major boards, and certainly all of them would probably benefit from something like this as well. I think my request would be that, and Mr. Okulich, hopefully you'd be able to help us with this, that if we do pass this bill, which I don't think is unreasonable, that we track how many people avail themselves of it and whether there are people who are asking for who you really don't think are appropriate. Because then we may want to consider similar legislation for some of the other major licensing boards going forward. We ought to keep things relatively equitable. I don't want to deprive the public of its right to know by any means, but I also think that there are some things that can be subject to misinterpretation, and we do want to reward people for addressing any major concerns and not having apparent blemishes on a record that really has not been stained for a long period of time, and when it was not something that hurt patients. So I personally would hope that you would all would be able to report back to us at some point in the not too distant future, so we can figure out if this is something we ought to be trying with other boards as well.
Yes. Madam Chair, yes. Senator Hayward, I would echo that, at least on the House floor, Representative Greenlake did mention something similar to say this was probably not the start of the discussion or the end of the discussion, but really the start, and wanted to engage some of the other associations as well as some of the other boards and maybe continue looking at this in a future legislative session. So there is some continuity on the other side.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. With that, I'll close. Is that all?
Yes.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40. House Bill 4095.
Now open a work session.
And we will open a work session. Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment into House Bill.
Do we know where Senator Shields is?
He was right here. Okay. It wasn't my day to watch him.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Here he comes. So we're fine. Okay. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 4095.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 4095. Any discussion? Is there any opposition? It is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4095 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 49 House Bill 4095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Did I say as amended? Yes, as amended. Colleagues, I am okay with this. The sideboards that were put in, I mean, the violation occurred over 10 years. The mistake harmed zero patients, either financially or physically. The violation was self-reported. There have been zero violations since, and the person had to comply with all the penalties. So I see no problem with passing this. Any other discussion, no, Senator?
Madam Chair, thank you. Just to reiterate what Senator Steiner Hayward said is, it'd be nice to track this and see if this is appropriate for other boards as well.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
Hill? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Girard will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4095 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4104. And the Representative Nose has already testified, and we have Scott Berry and Gary Allen.
This is the last bill?
Yeah.
Yes.
Be patient.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. As Representative Nose explained, this bill is a fairly simple bill. It redefines, or I should say defines, exactly what limited benefit coverage is. In the past, these types of policies have gotten kind of confused and brought into bills that maybe they weren't meant to be put in. And a good example of that, a few sessions ago, there was a bill where ambulance providers were paid directly from insurers. We got mistakenly placed in that bill and ended up for about 18 months to 2 years having to pay, in some cases, both our policyholder and the ambulance company. Last session, a similar bill from the hospital folks came forward. We were able to actually, within that bill, with help from both the House and Senate Health Committees, get out of both the intent to put us in the hospital bill and to remove ourselves from the ambulance bill without any opposition from the ambulance folks, who I think realized at that point that we probably weren't supposed to be in there in the first place. So the real point I just want to make is this really just clarifies who we are. If you want us in legislation in the future, you simply say limited benefit coverage. If you don't want us in the future, you remove limited benefit coverage, and it kind of clarifies for everyone in the legislature what those policies do and don't do.
Sense.
Is there any discussion?
Just for technical assistance?
Yes, sir. I'm Gary Allen, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Gary Allen with Aflac. Just wanted to echo Scott's comments. Okay.
We've taken a couple runs at this thing, so okay.
We have,
yes.
I think the whole committee is familiar with this
issue.
Yeah,
I believe that's true.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for coming. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4104 and open a work session on House Bill 4104.
I got it right that time.
That's
I'm
right.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4104 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what Scott Berry is going to do if we pass this bill. It's going to cut into his profit margin.
Any other profound discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries and Senator Shields.
I've carried my last bill. Today was my last
bill. No, you carried your last Shields bill.
I'd be happy to carry it.
Thank you, Senator Shields. And I will close the work session on House Bill 4104. And, we only have, committee, we only have three more bills in our committee. And can I have Thursdays? This is what's going to be on Thursday. House Bill 4105, House Bill 4107A, and House Bill 4141A. And I do know that there are amendments going being proposed for House Bill 4107 and 4141. And so I've asked, they've gone through you?
Yes.
They're, and as soon as we get them out, we're going to put them on OLIS. So I know we won't be moving them, but hopefully we'll have the amendments by
tomorrow,
Wednesday.
Possibly.
And so then people better hurry up and look at them, and yeah, so we know what to do with them.
Yeah, Madam Chair, these are supposedly technical, so we will need to make sure that that's exactly what they are.
Yeah,
yeah,
compliance with federal laws,
those
things like that.
Minor things like that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. With that. Any other?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I just want to introduce Dr. Kristen Gilbert, who's sitting down there. As some of you may know, OHSU is one of 20 family medicine programs across the country doing a pilot program to extend the residency from 3 years to 4 years, and part of that is a leadership curriculum. Dr. Gilbert is one of our stellar fourth-year residents, and as part of their leadership curriculum, many of them come and do some job shadowing with me. Why, I do not understand, but trying to get them a sense of some of the policy things that we do. So I'm delighted to have Dr. Gilbert with me. It's been a pleasure and a privilege working with her since she joined OHSU almost 4 years ago now. We're hoping we're going to get to keep her on as faculty. So
great.
I just wanted
to welcome
Dr. Gilbert here today.
With that, we're adjourned. With that, we're adjourned.